From Buck's studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, you can call this number right now, 800-462-7413. And Zorba, before our first call, tell us about the topics we'll have this hour.
Yes, we're going to talk about pesticide residue in fruits and vegetables, mm-hmm. which ones tend to have more and which ones tend to have less. And then we're going to discuss peanuts, the beneficial effects of peanuts on cardiovascular health, and then new information about peanuts and children and what we should do to try to keep our kids from having peanut allergies.
Yeah, interesting stuff. What's our recipe?
The Mighty Mushroom Chili. Have you ever had the Mighty Mushroom Chili?
I don't believe I have.
The Mighty Mushroom Chili is delicious chili, and you will like this if you like mushrooms.
Mm-hmm. Again, 800-462-7413, our toll-free number. And Zorba, to the phones now, welcoming our first caller, a listener in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
I am fixing in a few months to be 40 years old, and I have never exercised in my life besides probably the past month and a half I started.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering how often I should do it, how long I should do it, mainly for my health, and also to help me, hopefully, to kick the bad habit of smoking.
Oh, you say you're starting to do it now. What are you doing now?
I probably do maybe some cardio, which is on the elliptical, for probably 20 to 25 minutes. I try to do a mile and a half at least,
mm-hmm.
and then I will do 3 repetitions either on leg machines or arm machines, and mm-hmm. I rotate that every time I go.
Oh, how often are you going?
Well, here recently it's been midterm, so I've kind of skipped out a little bit, but I was normally doing it about 4 times a week.
Oh, okay. So midterm means slouch time? Is that what that means?
That means my brain is really tired, and
yeah.
I'm constantly studying, so I don't have the hour and 15 minutes to head over to the gym.
I've got it.
Which makes me feel really slouchy.
Yeah, well, but you know, that's how things go. So you're fixing to be 40. In other words, you're at 40, and you've smoked since you were how old?
I'm ashamed to say, but since 14.
Yeah, I was going to say 14, 15. I mean, that is actually pretty common. You've tried to quit smoking before, or you haven't?
I have. Mm-hmm. Actually, 2 months ago, I quit for a total of 9 days.
Uh-huh.
I went outside and I wanted a cigarette and I
had one.
Tough it, yeah.
That's right. A little bit more on the smoking. Did you use any medicine to quit, either nicotine replacement or bupropion known as Zyban or Chantix?
No, I just completely quit cold turkey, and I would like to quit that way.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I have read that it takes, you know, 7 days for the nicotine to completely get out of your body.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's true, and I'm hoping that if I continue this exercise, it could hopefully maybe get all the toxins out of there faster for me.
Well, I don't know if exercise will get the toxins out quicker. I mean, it's not sort of the way the body works. Nicotine is there for a while. The habit, the addiction, is in the brain for a long, long time. I quit in 1969. I still have the desire periodically. Sausage pizza, thin crust, and a Coke, and I want a Marlboro. I can taste it. It's very strange because I was 14 and we weren't supposed to be smoking. I'd be with my buds. We're playing poker. I've got the image right there, and it hits me, and I want a Marlboro. Now, am I going to have a Marlboro? Of course not. I'm nowhere near having a Marlboro. And besides, I can't stand the smell of smoke, but the memory is obviously still there for me, and I'm probably a pretty typical person, and took me 4 times to quit. Half the people can quit on a gradual basis, half on a cold turkey. The real issue is the 90 days to 6 months after quitting. There are a lot of people that come back, and that's what happened to you. Something throws it off, like you said, stresses of this or stresses of that. Exercise helps. Now, does it get rid of the toxins? Probably not. The toxins that you have of nicotine are eliminated by your liver, and exercise doesn't affect your liver, but exercise does increase the chances that you'll quit smoking because you feel better. In other words, cardiovascular health helps people quit smoking. Exercise, especially if they go, really, I can make this better, I can pump my body up, just is much more likely to motivate you and do it. So, and as a 40-year-old, you can pretty much do what you want to, and you're doing the right stuff. 20 to 25 minutes on the elliptical, some upper body weights, maybe some leg strengthening on leg machines. I think you're doing just fine.
Great. Okay.
So one more question. When are you going to quit?
Well, the thing is I go to school during the summer as well.
Mm-hmm. You have a Do you have a quit date?
I don't. No.
Okay. That's
feel like that if I make that, then I don't feel like I have enough willpower to go through with it.
Well, let me tell you, there's a new study that shows that people, you can have a 25 to 30% success rate, which is phenomenal with smoking, if you quit gradually. At 1 month, you have 25% fewer cigarettes. At 2 months, you have around two-thirds fewer cigarettes. And at 3 months, you then quit. So the gradual method, according to this study, worked better than the cold turkey method. And that you could start today, and you could put a quit date for yourself 3 months in advance. The weather's going to be warm. You're going to feel better. And that's what I would challenge you to do as soon as you get off the phone.
Okay. I can do that.
Good luck. That's right. Yeah. Gradual may do it.
Remember, we have your phone number.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Tom is going to follow up. There you go. Thanks for your call.
You're welcome, and thanks. We appreciate the call at 800-462-7413.
You know, I know you used to smoke a pipe. How many times did it take you to quit smoking?
One day I was sitting out in the backyard smoking my pipe, and I thought, I don't want to do this anymore. So I gathered up all my pipes, and I had a ton of them, my tobacco. I threw them in the garbage, and I never smoked
again.
And that
was it? And what? How many years did you smoke a pipe for?
25 years. Yeah. 27.
Yeah, so you just decided, why did you start smoking it? So you look smarter?
Yeah. I was bad in school, and I wanted to be an intellectual, so I bought a pipe.
Yeah, pipe would make you look, I remember those, make you look like you were smart. Cigarettes made you look sexy, and a pipe made you look intelligent. Right. Yes, how intelligent is it smoking a pipe?
I know. 800-462-7413. On to our next caller, Zorba, a listener in St. Augustine, Florida. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. How can we help?
Well, I was having some strange heart feelings, and I didn't know what was going on, along with some chest pressure. So I went to my doctor, and she said, well, go ahead and take your pulse and tell me what happens. And sure enough, my heart, like, stopped. And then it would start up again, like boom, like big boom. And it did that quite often. And so they hooked me up to the EKG, and and after a while, decided they felt one of them and said it was a benign heart palpitation.
Okay.
And so so I started the process of elimination myself. And I stopped coffee. That didn't do anything. All it did was give me headaches. And I thought, life without coffee. No fun.
I certainly agree with that.
Yeah.
Although coffee and caffeine products are a major cause of palpitations. I mean,
okay,
they are benign
PVCs,
which are, they're called premature ventricular contractions, which on the whole are benign. And certain types of fast heart rate can be caffeine instigated. I just want to tell you. So if you weren't off of caffeine for 2 to 3 weeks, you don't know whether or not that's part of the whole thing.
I started caffeine after about 4 days, I think, something like that. But I stopped all my other medication. I stopped taking all the allergy stuff. I even stopped my high cholesterol medicine, which I was only taking Zetia because I can't take statins. And after about 2 weeks, I haven't had one.
Okay. Well, it may, first of all, it may have been related to the medications you were on. That's a possibility. Extra heartbeats and an irregular heart can come and go. So over time, you'll find out. If you continue to have irregular heartbeats, I'd recommend a Holter monitor, H-O-L-T-E-R, because it measures you for 24 hours. We'll find out what the extra beats are. You don't really know unless you're monitored what those extra beats are. You can deduce they're probably this, but you don't really know. And there are different treatments for it. The Zetia does reduce cholesterol, but there's no good evidence that the Zetia actually reduces cardiovascular mortality. So I call it a cosmetic drug because it cosmetically reduces your cholesterol, but unlike a statin, it doesn't show prevents heart attacks and strokes. So stopping the Zetia was okay to do. What else did you stop? The Zetia? What else?
The Singulair.
And the Singulair. Okay.
And the Claritin. I mean, I haven't needed the inhaler because I don't have that pressure.
So you're not taking anything now? Any supplements that you take? Supplements?
Every once in a while, you know, I'll take a vitamin.
Yeah, but you want to stay away from supplements. A lot of supplements contain ephedrine. Ephedrine can cause a fast and an irregular pulse. And they don't list it. They'll go natural products. I don't know what they list as ephedrine. But they don't always list ephedrine because supplements are regulated like cosmetics. You know, feel stronger, you know, look brighter, be happier. Mm-hmm. They can say all of this anecdotal information without proving any of it. But ephedrine
is... By supplements, do you mean like any kind of vitamins, like a multivitamin?
Well, a regular multivitamin is okay. Multivitamin. Okay. If it says multivitamin USP, which means U.S. Pharmacopoeia, it's okay. But if they come back, I'd get a Holter monitor, see what this is. And if not, maybe it was drug-related to what you had.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, that's a big help. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for calling. Good luck. Let us know what happens.
Now, you say a multivitamin is okay, but you just told me a few weeks ago that multivitamins don't do anything.
Well, she didn't ask that question, so I didn't answer that question.
Didn't ask that question. It won't help you.
You asked that question. Well, the data on multivitamins is skimpier and skimpier, but that wasn't the question that was asked. I have learned to answer the questions, Tom.
Listeners, be on the alert.
That's
sure
right.
Word your question correctly.
That's right. Because if not, you may not get the complete answer, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
Here comes the Environmental Working Group, Zorba, that tells us some foods we should buy organic and others we shouldn't.
Well, what they actually did was they looked at pesticide residues. So let's move it in there. And they gave it an answer, a dirty dozen and the clean 15 for pesticide residue. So if they looked, for instance, at apples, 80% of the apples in the United States were contaminated by a residue called DPA, and it really hasn't changed much over the years. If you look at celery, cherry tomatoes, cucumbers, grapes, these were what they called the dirty dozen. Peaches, potatoes. So if you're interested in pesticide residue, you want to spend your money buying organic from the dirty dozen. But then, they called them the clean 15. I like these terms, the clean 15, where there was no residue. And it's very interesting. So I'm going to give you an example that I was sort of surprised at. Asparagus.
Yeah.
I would have thought asparagus would have a residue because it's green and the way they grow it, but it didn't. Avocado, of course, we don't eat the inside of the avocado. Cabbage. So cabbage, according to their, didn't have any residue, but cucumbers did. Cauliflower. And so you can't look at these and know which ones have residues and which ones do not have residue. Sweet corn.
Does not.
Did not have any residue. It was clean. In other words, the way
used pesticides.
But in the testing by this particular group, which has been testing for many, many years, the Environmental Working Group, the testing showed that there was not pesticide residue in the product when it reached the market, and the demand basically for organically produced food, which has increased dramatically. It's a $15 billion a year industry. Mm-hmm. You can now buy organics at Target and Walmart. So shows you how mainstream it is really having to do with pesticides. I mean, that's ultimately what organic's about. So this particular list shows you if you want to use your money correctly, if you're not going to buy all organic, you can look at the dirty dozen. That's what they call them, the Environmental Working Group, and make those the organics. So once again, we're looking at pesticide residue in the product, the vegetable or fruit.
Yeah.
We're not looking at the use of pesticides. We know that organics do not use pesticides. We know that. And we know if it doesn't say organic, pesticides are probably used. We're looking at what's left in the product. And certainly as a parent with young children, if you're interested in that, those are the things to pay attention to.
It is interesting. 800-462-7413. And Zorba, our next caller is a listener in Ada, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Fine. How can we help?
You remember a show a couple of weeks back that I heard that said that you and Zorba both have suffered from migraines? I've suffered from migraines since I was six. I went through all the tests, like when I was in my 20s, MRIs, CAT scans, the whole gamut. I'm just got on insurance again, and I'm about to go to another doctor to see if I can't get some kind of relief.
Oh, sure, sure. Tom actually doesn't get migraines, but I do. I've gotten I've had migraines since I was five. I have fewer migraines now than before, and there is no test for migraines. MRI and CAT scans for headaches, on the whole, are a waste of money and resources because they don't prove anything. And so you don't need any more testing. If you've got a migraine, the real issue is, what do you take to prevent the migraine? So how many migraines a month are you getting?
I'm actually down to mine where mine are, I guess you call them grade one migraines. It's something I have one almost every day.
Okay, so you've got one every day. Have you been on medicines for that at all, on a daily medication?
The one that I took for a while, and it was the only medication I've ever really found to do much good, is Imitrex, Sumatriptan.
Well, Imitrex, Sumatriptan is very good for the acute migraine, but we have a number of drugs that are good at migraine prevention, and they will often cut down 50% of the migraines, and they'll be 50% as strong. But the commonly used migraine prophylaxis medications fall into a couple of classes. One is called a beta blocker. And propranolol, P-R-O-P-R-A-N-O-L-O-L, sort of the major player in this. But there are other things such as nandrolol. There are about six different beta blockers. And beta blockers can be very effective in the reduction of migraines. They're a blood pressure pill, but in small amounts, they usually don't affect blood pressure. They're very good. Another pill that is used is Topamax, topiramide, which is now a generic. Full disclosure, I do research in my office. We tested Topamax a number of years ago when it was a name brand medication. And Topamax at the 25 to 50 milligrams twice daily, as I said, it's generic now. It's been very effective in reducing migraines, maybe 50% as often 50% of the time. And some days a combination of both, adding a little aspirin, adding over-the-counter Excedrin migraine can also be very effective. And those are kind of the things I would look at. I'd go to a doc and I would try these different medications. There are a number of good medicines that can help reduce your migraines, you know, so you don't have to use the Imitrex as much. But you do not need testing. That's the most important thing. Testing is done.
Okay.
Good luck. Please let us know what happens.
Yeah, appreciate the call at 800-462-7413. And before we take a break, Zorba, on we go to our newest segment. Throughout the history of medicine, we've seen countless contraptions and elixirs claiming to cure ailments and professing miraculous health benefits. Let's wade into the murky past of such falsities and medical quackery in our newest segment we call Quacking Up with Dr. Zorba.
Quack it up.
Okay, Zorba, you know how our moms would always tell us to make sure you chew your food? Well, this guy's mom must have been very proud. Tell us about Horace Fletcher.
Horace Fletcher, who was also called the Great Masticator. That's right.
We can say that on the radio?
Well, we can say mastication on the radio.
Oh, okay.
There are other words that we have to be more careful of.
Yeah.
But Horace Fletcher, and Fletcherism is what it was called, he recommended that food should be chewed 100 times before it was swallowed. That you masticate your food 100 times before you follow. And he had a number of followers, John D. Rockefeller, among others, who, if you look at his pictures, was a very thin guy because he chewed his food 100 times before he swallowed. And he recommended that you do this because it was very important to get saliva mixed with the food. And in addition, what he did was afterwards, he would examine human waste, excrement, yeah, to see whether or not you chewed enough. And if you chewed enough, your poop, he claimed, would be different than if you didn't chew.
You know,
come on. This is our crackery. But he became very, very wealthy. He became a millionaire, which basically because he was promoting this. Upton Sinclair, Henry James, Rockefeller, a lot of people had this idea. And when he was at the old age of 58, he went to Yale and he competed with the Yale athletes and apparently did as good or better than a lot of Yale athletes, which I think says something about the Yale athletes more than it says about Horace Fletcher. Yeah. But Fletcherism means chew your food 100 times. Now, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
He also said, don't eat until you're good and hungry. So imagine if you're good and hungry and you chew 100 times. His hope was that you would do the 100 chews within a minute. So it was like, and you'd have to count. Yeah. You know, it would be very hard to get you. These people did not weigh much.
I've got to tell you, when I was a kid, relatives, when we have dinner at other people's homes, would kind of jokingly say, you have to chew your food 100 times.
Oh, really? Did your relatives say that?
Yeah, but they weren't serious about it.
No, but that was probably
that was, he was
popular in the 30s and 40s.
Yeah.
And he was ultimately supplanted by another fad that we have today. Do you know what that fad is?
No.
Calorie counting.
Oh.
It's a fad. It's not really a fad, but ultimately Horace Fletcher was replaced by calorie counting, and Fletcherism has now gone into the dustbin of history.
Yeah, calorie counting is a good
thing. Calorie counting is still there, but we won't call that quackery. But we will expose other quacks in the future.
Yeah, stay tuned. Do you have an example of medical quackery to contribute to this new segment? Or if you just want to chew the fat, send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org or post it on Facebook.
Coming up, our recipe. You'll want to chew it 100 times. After the recipe, some more of your calls. We have our medical myth buster later on and maybe another email or two. All right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health, 800-462-7413 if you have a question for Zorba. But before our next caller, Zorba, what's our recipe?
Yes, mighty mushroom chili. Do you like chili?
Yeah, I'm kind of on mushrooms.
Uh-huh. Oh, you don't like mushrooms? They're not your thing?
Not very much.
How about like mushroom soup?
No,
mushrooms, never. You know, mushrooms are an acquired adult taste, and I think you're not liking that.
You have not yet
become an adult.
Okay.
Even though you're a pensioner, you have not become an adult. It's not a vegetarian recipe. It's a very good recipe, though.
Okay.
Start out with a pound of lean ground beef, and you could also use lean turkey meat if you want to.
That would be good. Okay, a pound of lean ground beef or turkey.
Or turkey meat. And if you pick turkey meat, you want to make sure that it's lean.
Yeah.
It's relatively lean because otherwise it has as much fat, roughly as much fat. One medium onion diced.
A medium onion diced.
6 ounces of fresh mushrooms halved.
6 ounces of fresh mushrooms halved.
And if you love mushrooms like I do, I would just throw in the whole package.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I would do. I mean, mushrooms have pretty much no calories, so you can mushroom this as you want to.
Mm-hmm.
One jalapeno pepper seeded and chopped.
Mm-hmm. Jalapeno pepper seeded and chopped.
And remember, the heat in the pepper is in the seeds and the middle where the seeds are attached to. So if you're going to seed and chop a jalapeno, do it with gloves or wash your hands afterwards.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So you don't do something I did years ago, which was was scratch my eyes after seeding a jalapeno pepper. Two cloves of garlic chopped. Two cans of chili beans undrained.
What kind of beans do you – do you use chili beans when you do chili?
I actually use a mixture. So I use a pink bean and I use a red bean because
we
like
love
the
dark red beans.
You like the dark red beans. So you like beans. You're a bean person.
Oh, yeah.
Like beans.
Okay.
Two cans of chili tomatoes. Those would be tomatoes that are chopped up or diced. And I like the fire roasted, by the way.
Yeah. Two cans of chili beans.
I wonder if they really roast it in a fire when they call it fire roasted.
I wouldn't bet on it.
Fire roasted. Yeah. Truth in, you know, I have to go to Google and find that out. 8 ounces of crushed pineapple drained.
Mm-hmm. 8 ounces of crushed pineapple. Drained.
Drained. And 1 ounce of chili seasoning.
Mm-hmm. Ounce of chili seasoning.
Okay. Really easy to put together in a large skillet. Cook the ground beef or ground turkey and onion until it's no longer pink. And, of course, with the turkey, because turkey can have salmonella like chicken, of course, meat can have E. coli, you want to make sure it's no longer pink. Very important. Drain it. Get rid of the fat that's in there. It's very important to drain it. Otherwise, you're getting fat you don't need. Then take all of the ingredients, put it in a slow cooker. This is a slow cooker recipe. Simmer on medium heat for about 30 minutes stirring occasionally. You can also put it in a pot if you want to, besides a slow cooker, a pot on the stove. And then serve it topped with some pepper jack cheese or maybe a little chunk of your favorite crusty bread.
Does the slow cooker do anything that's throwing it in a pan or in a pot?
No, you could do it in a pan. Yeah. But remember, slow cookers and chili go hand in hand. Isn't that your image of chili?
It should be in a slow cooker, you know what I mean?
It's a style issue. It's a style issue. And then if you want to keep it going all day while you're watching your favorite sports event, you could do that. Basketball, baseball, football, soccer, ping pong. I'm just going to try to get as many as I can. Ping pong. Ping pong is not big here. But if you're in China, ping pong would be big. Getting to the calories, it's about 228 calories. We calculate roughly 200 calories. This will serve about 8 people. So it's really a cup of this. Have it with a nice salad, crusty bread. If you would like this recipe.
Can we go on the web?
ZorbaPastor.org or find us through Facebook. And once again, you can see our photos and a lot of other fun stuff. That's ZorbaPastor.org.
800-462-7413. We have a line open now for you if you'd like to join in. And a Buffalo, New York listener is with us now. Hi.
Hi, Dr. Zorba. This question has been plaguing me for years. And then about a year ago, my wife, who weighs 95 pounds, has never smoked, has an extremely healthy diet, practices yoga, rides a bike, walks everywhere, had a major heart attack. Emergency bypass surgery. She's doing great. She's fine. Everything was healed very well. But as you know, we live in Buffalo, and you may have heard, you know, we get a little snow every now and then.
Yes, I have heard that.
And so whenever it snows, there are warnings on the radio and TV about the dangers of shoveling and heart attacks. So my question is, who is at risk? Everyone or just people like my wife who, whether they know it or not, are probably going to have a heart attack anyway?
Who's at risk? Before I answer the question, my real question, the underlying question is, do you want your wife to shovel for you? is that why you're asking that? That's really...
She's out there right now. I don't know if I...
I can read in between the lines.
No, actually, I'm looking for an excuse not to shovel,
I'm not sure. And that's it. So, first of all, if you shovel a little bit about this, people who are prone to heart disease are the ones we have to... I mean, you know, 25-year-olds, 50-year-olds who are healthy with no heart disease. Your wife did everything right, and she still had a heart attack. And was her cholesterol very high? Was that abnormal? Had she ever had it checked?
It was medium high.
Okay,
you know, she had been warned about it, but I think It was genetic.
Yeah. No, and that's ultimately what it is. And it's inevitably genetic, and it may be genetic with a high cholesterol and genetic without a high cholesterol. Also, heart disease can be random. I had a friend of mine taught at the University of Wisconsin. His dad lived to 102. His mom lived to 98. And he perished at the age of, it was either 67 or 68, of a sudden heart attack. Out of the blue, never smoked, exercised, did everything right. His first symptom basically was chest pain, and he was gone in a very short period of time. So she had the genetic predisposition or the random event. Now, when we lift, part of the issue is I once calculated if you shovel a heavy snow like they have in Buffalo, because they don't have champagne powder, and you do it in the typical speed that people do, it's roughly, you're moving roughly 0.5 to 1 ton of snow every 20 minutes. Now, if I told you, if I put a ton of bricks in your driveway and said, move these in 20 minutes, you'd call me nuts. I mean, you'd say, I'm not going to do that. But yet when we have snow in the shovel, we go, well, I'm just going to get this finished. And so we work harder. We hold our breath. We go, ugh. We lift something heavier than we normally do. People who are out of shape, especially if they hold their breath, are more likely to have a heart attack, and especially if they're predisposed. So one of my recommendations is if you're going to shovel, take your time. If you have heart disease, the answer is don't shovel. Pay that teenager. But if you're, or get a snowblower, but if you're going to shovel, you want to take your time and you want to do it slowly, and you don't want to lift enough in the shovel so you are going, ugh, and you're increasing your intrathoracic pressure, which decreases some of the flow to the coronary arteries. Yeah. So the that's the long answer. The short answer is you have to shovel around your house and your wife gets to watch whatever she wants to watch. Downton Abbey. Your wife gets to watch Downton Abbey and you get to shovel along the walkway. Sorry.
Yeah, well, that might not be the answer I wanted to hear.
Thanks so much. Good luck to you, Will. Yeah, best of wishes.
We appreciate the call. I shovel the walk, and I have a snowblower now. And
How do you like it? I love it.
When I got the blower, my kind of guideline was if the snow was more than, say, 3 or 4 inches, I would use the blower. Otherwise, I would shuffle. Then a few years ago, I thought, what if it's more than 2 inches? I'll use the blower. And now it's about a dusting of snow. I get that blower out because I don't want to shovel at all.
That's right. It's wonderful stuff, isn't it? I mean, it really does.
800-462-7413 to Ironwood, Michigan now. Hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure, what's up?
I have a problem with sleep. I'm able to fall asleep, but I wake up at early hours in the morning, sometimes 3:45, and I cannot go back to sleep. And I did hear Zorba say that you can reset your circadian clock.
Sure, what time do you go to sleep at night?
At 10:30.
Okay, so at 10:30. And then you get up at 4 o'clock.
I don't get up at 4 o'clock. I just stay in bed and stay warm.
You stay in bed and stay warm, that's right,
yes.
Which is good. Do you read?
I did read, but I have macular degeneration, so I'm not able to read much.
A couple things. First of all, as you know, when we get older, we don't sleep as well. Children have a circadian rhythm that is very malleable. Imagine, you know, you're a child. You can lift up a kid and move them from one spot to another, and they don't wake up.
Right.
Imagine if somebody scooped you out of bed in the middle of the night. You would definitely wake up. You'd say, what are you doing? And you would wake up. I still have an image when my Uncle Al used to lift me up and I was like
this is when you were 13.
This is when I was like 4 or 5. But I can still remember. He was a big guy, you know, 6'2" or something like that. But getting back to the issue, one of the things are that the 8 hours sleep in your bed was something that was generated during the Industrial Revolution because you had to get people into the factory. So the idea was you go to sleep, you sleep for 8 hours, you go into the factory, and you keep on working for 12 or 16 hours. So it's relatively new. If you look in areas where people are not industrialized, and there still are areas around the world, they often will sleep in periods for like 4 to 6 hours in a house that's noisy. You know, the idea of a bedroom and quiet by yourself does not exist in countries which are not industrialized. There's a lot of noise that goes on in the house, and in the evening there may be some noise. People often wake up for a half an hour to 45 minutes and then have a second sleep. And some of the sleep specialists call it a first sleep and second sleep. So how do you get back is the real issue when you're lying in bed and you're awake and, you know, you wake up during that low, you know, that sleep cycle that is not deep. One recommendation I would have, because you can't read anymore with macular degeneration, is that you get a book on tape. And they don't come on tape now. They come on the iPhone or DVD and some kind of tape. And you turn it on.
In the early mornings?
Yeah, 3:45, you turn it on. You have it next to you. Go to the washroom if you have to. That's what you should do. The other option is you turn on the radio. And
I do. I listen to the radio a lot. Mm-hmm.
And how long does it take you to go to sleep then?
I don't go back to sleep.
Uh-huh. So you only
I'm
need...
I'm not able to go back.
So you only need about 6 hours of sleep a night.
Is that enough?
Yeah, that's enough. Yeah, how do you feel during the day?
I lay down in the afternoon.
And you take a nap?
I don't think I sleep. I think I just... rest.
That's okay. Nothing wrong with that. I love to nap in the middle of the afternoon. Whenever I can, I'll grab a half an hour to 45 minutes of shut-eye in the middle of the day, and I feel like it's stolen time because for some reason I have my mother saying, get up and do something, when in fact you probably have the same mother.
Yes.
Yeah, she's still in our brain, isn't she?
Oh, yes. And I think of her all the time.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I think of my mom all the time, too. But 6 hours with a rest time in the middle of the day, nothing wrong with that, unless you're a teenager. And you are not a teenager, I can tell.
No, I know that. Far from it.
Far from it. Good luck. Let us know what happens.
Thank you very much your help.
Thank you so much for the call at 800-462-7413. And before the break, Zorba, time now to let one of our listeners give us a piece of their mind in a segment we call Disagreeing with the Doc. Today's email comes from a listener, Tim, in Bozeman, Montana. He writes, Dear Zorba, I heard you recently answer a question concerning ear candles, and I couldn't help but notice that your answer was the same that I often hear. Doctors will often talk vaguely about what an ear candle is and is supposed to do, and then say they don't think they work. No one ever seems to answer from the standpoint of personal experience or clinical laboratory results. I am not necessarily an ear candle believer, but I have used them, and I notice there's a big difference between the pre- and post-candled ear. Is there some conspiracy among doctors to either keep people from knowing the truth, or is there some clause in the Hippocratic Oath that prohibits experimenting with ear candles?
That's right. Well, first of all, I think there is a conspiracy. You're exactly right. There's no doubt about it. We are anti-ear candle with that. Well, first of all, you know, if people get relief, I mean, that's why I sort of I finesse this. If people get relief and they put it in and they say, I feel better, why not do it? Now, if there's no harm, no foul with an ear candle, that's okay. Clinical results, I don't think they're there. I don't think they're there. So, sorry, I don't think there are clinical results.
Yeah, but that's because you have that conspiracy
going on
and you don't study
And Hippocratic...
Really
Hippocratic Oath, thou shalt not use ear candles, is in the Hippocratic Oath. I rather doubt it. But conspiracy aside, anecdotal information is the most we have. There are no clinical studies that show that they work. Somehow, I think if there really were a clinical study, we doctors would start to recommend ear candling.
Do you disagree with something Zorba said on the show? We're all ears. Just post on our Facebook page or send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have another topic to talk about. That's coming up next. More of your calls, of course, are Medical Mythbuster 2, right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That toll-free number you know is 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, we talk about some nuts.
Yes, yes. We'll talk about peanuts in specific. Now, for many years, I've talked about nuts as being healthy, and I haven't talked about peanuts because they are a legume. They right. are not a tree nut. They don't grow on trees. Mm-hmm. They grow in the ground. And we know that eating a handful of nuts is very healthy because mm-hmm. of the oil that's in nuts. This is a recent study that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association that showed that all kinds of nuts, including peanuts, which once again are technically a legume, help reduce cardiovascular disease and heart attacks by up to 20%. And this was a study of studies. So it was one of the mega studies where they took basically up to 1 million people, looked at what the diets were that were looked at various studies. So it's got some weaknesses to it. We're looking back because on these longitudinal studies, they ask people how many nuts they have. And peanuts are helpful. Whether you smoke cigarettes, are obese, or a diabetic or so on, handful of peanuts every day. Yeah. Useful.
Well, 20% is a huge number, but you said up to 20%.
Well, because some of the studies show a little less, some of the studies showed a little bit more, and so the median was about 20%. And in China, half the studies occurred in China. Tree nuts like pistachios and cashews and walnuts are very expensive. So in China, in the Chinese studies, mm-hmm. they just looked at peanuts, which are a very common food in China. High protein, high fat, good calories. They don't have the same obesity problem in China that we do.
And we also have some good news about people with peanut allergies.
That's right. A landmark study that recently came out that looked at giving children peanut products early on reduces their risk of peanut allergy. Now, the CDC came out and said, wait a minute, don't all of a sudden start giving your kids peanuts early on. But for years, we doctors have said, wait, hold off on the peanuts for young children, because especially if you've got it in the family, because you may be producing a peanut allergy. And this particular study shows the opposite may be the case. It took place in Israel where there are lots of things made with peanuts, and they found a 70% reduction in peanut allergies. Peanut allergies affect a huge portion of the population. Maybe we should be introducing them earlier versus introducing them later.
What does early on mean?
Well, when your kids can have solid food. So it doesn't happen. Breast is best. We know that for the first six months of life.
But even as young as
Somewhere within the year of age. These are peanut products. These are not chewing peanuts, which are not healthy for a young child, but peanut products. But I think this is good news on the forefront. Peanut to help you when you're older. Peanuts when you're younger under a doctor's supervision. If you're worried about allergies, peanuts forever.
800-462-7413 is our number, and Zorba, our next caller, is in Maryville, Tennessee. Hi.
Hi, Dr. Zorba. First of all, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm. How can we help?
I have had a chronic pain problem for several years due to three back surgeries with ray cages, the third one being done in 2000, I believe. Plate and four screws in the neck and all kinds of other issues, but I was put on a painkiller called Percocet 5-325 or 6 years ago.
Mm-hmm. That's oxycodone. That's what Percocet contains. Mm-hmm.
I also take a low-dose lisinopril for blood pressure, 0.5 milligram, I believe it is.
5 milligrams, and okay.
I was wondering if every now and then, if I'm really, really sore, if I could take a couple of leave with those medications, because I know the Tylenol that's in the Percocet, I don't want to take any of that, but is a leave a possibility?
Oh, absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about Tylenol. The safety for Tylenol is up to 2,000 milligrams a day if you drink two drinks or more a day, and up to 4,000 milligrams a day if you don't drink more than like one and a half drinks a day. So the Tylenol data really shows liver failure, especially in alcoholics. That's really where it comes from. So 4,000 milligrams if you have a drink or two every day or you're a non-drinker, 2,000 milligrams if you're a drinker. And so people have a fear about Tylenol, rightfully so, but it's really in the 6,000 to 8,000 milligram dosage that we see most of the liver failure. Aleve, ibuprofen, which are over-the-counter anti-inflammatories, are very good. They come with their own risks. You can have GI bleeds. They're not common events, but they're not rare events either, and it can cause some gastric distress. But certainly, it can be used in addition. And a lot of people find an anti-inflammatory is very useful, if you will, as your basis. So, yeah, I would use them both together. And you said your surgeries were in the year 2000?
2000 and before. The third one was in 2000.
Okay, so you've lived with this for quite a long time. What do you do for a living?
40 years of drywall.
40 years of drywall. Mm. Well, that certainly took its toll. So I have a drywall question. Did you use stilts?
Yes, I used to. I try not to get on them too much anymore because they are hard on your back.
They're hard on the back, and they're dangerous. And there's some states where they're actually outlawed because of the dangers of falling off. And Tom is looking. They're not like they're stilts that are specially made for drywall.
Not so, like clowns one.
No, they're not clown stilts. I wasn't asking. Yeah, if you...
Yes, there are specially made stilts for drywall.
Okay. They're specially made stilts for drywall, so you do the job. So yeah, a little bit hard on the back, but the answer is yes. One or two leave twice a day. I always recommend. And generic is just as good as name brand. Start out with two twice a day for 2 weeks. If you feel better, then go down to one twice a day and see if that works as well. I have some people on it every day, and some people just take it as needed. See what works for you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Thank
Pleasure,
you
sir.
So much for the call at 800-462-7413. And Zorba, time again now for our medical myth buster. Today's question is from a listener named Janet in Billings, Montana. She writes, I am 67 years old, very active, and have osteoporosis. I presently take 1 calcium 600 milligram plus D3. My doc suggested I take a Tums once a day as well to increase my calcium to 1200 milligrams. My sister just about had a stroke when I told her I was taking Tums for some of my calcium. She said the calcium in Tums wouldn't be absorbed well and that other horrible things, and that's in quotes, might happen.
Horrible things. Horrible I wonder things. What those horrible things were.
I like taking Tums because they are chewable and easy to take, and I need to know if this is just a myth. Many thanks for your consideration.
It is a myth because Tums are calcium. That's it. So when you're taking your calcium tablet and you're taking Tums, you're taking the same thing. It is inorganic. Calcium is an element. But one thing I recommend is that the calcium in dairy products, if you can tolerate dairy products and if you like dairy products, seems to be absorbed differently. So I would recommend no more than 500-600 milligrams of calcium. Do not take 1,000 milligram tablet because that sudden increase in calcium level in your bloodstream is not good for your heart. But dairy products are a good way to add to it. And spinach, be like Popeye.
But when the doc says get the calcium up to 1,200 milligrams, that's not right.
Well, I think you don't want to take it all at one time. And if you've got osteoporosis, so you've got to be you should be above 1,000 milligrams. 1,200 milligrams is okay. 1,800, I think, is overkill. But there's evidence that the calcium in dairy products may be absorbed differently. And so if you can have dairy products, do it as a mixture of inorganic calcium, Tums or a calcium tablet, vitamin D supplement, at least 2,000 units, and then calcium, containing dairy products are excellent. A combination.
Have a question for the good doc? Just send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org.
800-462-7413, our number, and a Menominee, Wisconsin listener with us now. Hi.
Hello, this is Josh.
What's up, Josh?
Well, my question is, am I creating antifungal resistant superbugs on my feet by using a antifungal cream every day as a preventative measure?
I don't think you're going to create a superbug. Why are you using an antifungal cream on your feet?
Sure, it started about 10 years ago that I began having scaling and peeling on the bottom of one of my feet. Started using tolnaphtate on that. It cleared it right up. Since that time, I've been using one of the cream preparations every day on my feet just to keep it away. It seems like if I stop that, the dry skin, the scaling comes back. I just had one small section of dry and scaly skin on my feet, even despite using that cream every day.
Well, there are a few things. First of all, you may be producing some resistance on your feet. There's no doubt about it. If you use anything that's antifungal, antibiotic, you always run a risk that the bugs, in this case, the fungal infection that is not affected by the antifungicide, may be the ones that take over your feet. So my recommendation is at least have some time off with the antifungal cream and see if you need it. So have you spent any time off the cream at all?
Just a matter of maybe a week at a time.
And what's happened during that week?
It's come back.
In other words, your feet become drier and more scaly? Is that what happens?
They do, and it's even begun to peel a little bit again.
Uh-huh. Well, I would still go through a period of time where I would not use the cream for a couple of weeks, and I would probably do that 4 times a year. That's what I would do. And therefore, that might help with the resistance. On the other hand, you've been using it for 10 years, and all you have is a little patch. So, you know, you haven't, in 10 years, using it every day, you've not developed resistance now. You may never develop resistance. So the other way of looking at it is say, hey, it's been working for me for 10 years, roughly almost the whole time. It may continue to work with you.
Okay. Well, thanks very much.
You're welcome. Pleasure is ours.
We appreciate the call. And before we head out today, Zorba, let's take a quick email question from a listener named Ashley. I love this email, by the way.
Oh, good.
She writes, Dear Dr. Zorba, I was fresh out of the shower the other day and decided to clean out my belly button. There was nothing in there.
There was nothing in there,
but it got me thinking. Are belly buttons specific to the doctor and how they clamp the umbilical cord? Or is it something we just inherit?
Well, it's not how you clamp the umbilical cord because they fall off. What happens is you don't clamp it at the belly. You clamp it an inch or two above the belly, and then the cord falls off.
So is it inherited?
You know, that's a good question. That's a good question. We'll all have to check with our moms and dads to see what they actually have. Do we have an innie or an outie?
I don't know that. Our going to help on this.
I am stumped.
Take a look at your kids and your parents' belly buttons and yours and see what
you
find.
Should they send us photos?
That'd be good.
Belly button photos?
That'd be great.
On Facebook? Way to go. Belly button photos on Facebook. We will post them, though. Three generations are better. Two generations are okay. Three are even better. Four would be great. Five would be awesome. Five would be awesome. We need a belly button contest.
Have a question for the good doc? Just send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org. Does that mean we have to show our belly buttons?
No. But we'll see you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org or through Facebook.
Don't forget, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. Our executive producer is Carl Christensen, and our technical director is Brad Colbert. Our theme music is by Leon Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, expecting your company on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0321Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic, and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at zorbapastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.